Disclaimer. The views and opinions you hear expressed by the participants in this show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show! Everybody, welcome to AnCast. I'm Zach Burchie, returning to the show. It's been a long time, but we're very happy to have him back. It's the vice president and co-owner of New Generation Pictures, Jonathan Klein. Jonathan, thanks for coming on the show.
Hey, it's great to be back after such a long time.
Yeah, it's been like four years.
Something. I think the last time we did it was either promoting a Street Fighter or a Marvel vs. Capcom or something like that.
I think it might have been Marvel vs. Capcom, so 2011.
Mm-hmm.
But we had you and Talis and Jaff on, and you know that
just to correct you, it's Chalice and Jaffe,
sorry,
not Jaff.
Excuse me. I will link back to that interview where hopefully I also pronounce his name correctly. Just for people who don't know you or aren't familiar with New Generation Pictures, can you sort of give us the resume right out of the gate here?
Well, we've been in business since 95, but we've been working on dubbing, translating, subtitling, localizing anime and video games since about 1999. And, you know, after the big anime crash of 2007-2008, we mostly worked in video games, but on occasion I get to work on anime. And, you know, I work as both a producer and or director. Some of the titles I've worked on include Paranoia Agent, Ergo Proxy, ROD the TV, of course, the original Helsing TV and Helsing Ultimate. In terms of video games, I've worked on several of the Final Fantasy titles. I've worked on Street Fighter, Street Fighter 4, and all iterations since then, Marvel vs. Capcom 3 and Ultimate Marvel vs. Capcom 3. I direct a lot of RPGs for different clients. Sometimes I work on smaller phone app, tablet app games, things like that as well. One of my big clients at this point is Marvel Comics. I do a lot of stuff for them in terms of small games and some of their larger online MMOs as well.
Cool. Yeah, I would imagine, like, we'll get to the game stuff in a little bit here, but I'm going to come back to that, the idea, you know, doing a lot of work for, like, mobile stuff, tablets and phones and things like that. Specifically, we're kind of having you on the show here in anticipation of your anime work, which I guess this is, like, the biggest month for you for anime in a really long time, because you have two projects out on the same day.
Right, exactly. I mean, it's been years since I've had, like, multiple titles out on the same day, let alone the same month. We've had quite a dearth of anime work for a long time. I got to work on last year, Ikitosen Seasons 3 and 4, since we worked on originally Season 1 for Fun, and that was being done by Funimation. And, you know, the Helsing Ultimate, we've worked on that show for almost since 2005, doing chapter after chapter. And, you know, it was originally a Genion title, and then it went into sort of limbo, and then Funimation picked it up. And again, they sort of, you know, we got to work on 5 through 8 through them, and then we had to wait a while, and we got to finally work on the last two chapters, 9 and 10, just recently. So we're finishing that up. And Funimation also kindly approached us to work on Bayonetta Bloody Fate, which is the adaptation of the original Bayonetta original video game, the first one.
Right. And this is coming out here sort of at about exactly the same time as the sequel to that game.
Yes, pretty much. It's coming around the same time as the sequel.
Right. So let's start with Helsing, because I would say New Generation Pictures is as tied to Helsing as really anyone could be. you've been working on this show now for over a decade at this point, right?
Well, more if you count the original Helsing TV series, which we did back in 2001. I joke on the commentary track that one-third of my life has been involved with Helsing.
Yeah,
so
right.
I've lost, I've lost time and my hair thanks to Helsing, basically.
Right. So I guess the first question is, are you sad to see it end? I mean, this is it. These last two chapters, it's all the material that could possibly be animated unless they decide to do another remake. This is it. So are you sad to see it go?
Yes, it is kind of bittersweet. You know, we're sort of happy that we're sort of reaching a conclusion after many years of, you know, sort of we had this hurry up and wait kind of attitude where you would do something and then you'd wait a couple of years or a year or several years before you would do the next one. So it's finally nice to sort of put this series to bed. On the other hand, it's like being in school with a bunch of good friends who you've been, you know, hanging out with for a long time, and now you're all going to go your separate ways, going to college now or something like that.
Right.
So we're kind of feel there's sort of a little bit of sorrow as in terms of, well, I guess this is it, unless they do decide to bring us back, you know, I guess then we'll have another class reunion or something like that.
Right. Well, I mean, that dub, that original Helsing dub, the TV dub, really, I mean, you can totally stop me if I'm wrong here, kind of put you on the map for anime fans in particular and, like, you know, the world of dub fans who pay attention to the studios and the actors and, you know, the people involved with that involved in that side of the business. It really that's where you kind of made your mark and made a whole generation of fans of yours, I want to say. Because that dub was really impressive. I remember, I mean, I loved it at the time. Would you agree with that?
I would have to agree with you as well. It was kind of something that put us on the map, basically. We had done a few dubs prior to that. And I remember back in the day, you know, in fact, it was through Anime News Network, we saw some sort of, there was a link to some sort of promo clip for Helsing TV, which was really cool. Like, Gonzo had done this amazing animation clip for it. And I guess at the same time as I was watching it, Taliesin Jaffe, who directed Helsing TV and Helsing Ultimate, must have seen that same clip. And suddenly I get an email saying, I want to work on this. And so I said, okay, well, let me go contact Jenny Young since this is going to be, well, this was Pioneer back in the day.
Right.
I sent him an email. And they responded, okay, let's have a meeting. And it was, and surprisingly, what I've heard is that we weren't originally supposed to get Helsing, that because it was only a 13-episode series, they thought they would give us something bigger at that time, a larger show. And we sort of said, no, we really like this. This is the kind of thing we're really into. And, you know, we said, oh, and we know that Alucard spelled backwards as Dracula, and their response was, oh, really? And that kind of gave us a little pause when we heard that.
Right.
You know, so we had our trials and tribulations through Helsing, but we sort of persevered and got through that, and then the dub came out, and it sort of gave us a lot of accolades amongst the anime fandom. At that point, there was still a lot of negativity towards dubbing into English, saying, oh, it's not as good, that, you know, you're never going to get the same feelings from the Japanese that the Japanese have. But we said, well, if we're going to really approach this and this show takes place in England, we really need to get as much of a British cast as possible. And that was the way we started it from.
Right. And yeah, and that's what everyone was really impressed with, was because you had, you know, people with legit accents, not people faking it.
Yeah, although we still get a lot of people saying, oh, those British accents are so fake. And I'm like, okay, if you say so.
Yeah.
I'll tell them when they get back from England. That.
Yeah, well, that's why people were, I remember that being a big sticking point. But the other, you know, big thing was everyone was, you know, went pretty crazy for Crispin Freeman's performance. And then after that, I remember he routinely
right.
cast as heavies. Like, everyone wanted him to do the Alucard voice. So you
right.
heard it in, like, every other dub
Right. That was sort of the pivot moment for Crispin, from being this sort of light, sort of happy-go-lucky kind of characters. You know, sort of he went from, you know, doing Captain Tyler and thing and Slayers to suddenly he's doing this dark and heavy character that everybody said, oh, we didn't know you could do that. And now everybody wanted him to do that for everything. But, I mean, it did bring a lot of attention to Crispin. Crispin was such a great actor in the role, and he really made it its own, that it just worked out so well. And the funny thing is, when we were casting for it, originally the idea was we weren't trying to go for a British actor, we thought. And nobody just had the voice for it. And it was like either they were too light or too polite. Nobody had that darkness that we wanted in there. And Crispin came in. We were going to have him read for one of the other roles, so one of the supporting roles or one of the villains that appear in the different episodes. So, no, can I read for Alucard? And we said, okay. We were kind of doing – we sort of let him do it, indulged him in it, but we were going like, ah, it's not going to work. And then all of a sudden we heard him do it, like, holy shit. Yeah. This could work. And that's how we got Crispin on that.
Yeah, it was definitely unique at the time because, you know – okay. So, like, anime dubs back then have kind of had one of the same issues that anime dubs have now, where you're hearing the same 20 people in everything, and – that was one of the few times where it felt like that voice belonged to that character. Normally you don't hear that. Like, you hear Greg Ayers doing anything, and it's Greg Ayers' voice coming out of that character. But he was doing that voice for that character, and it really felt like it belonged to that character, which just basically never happens in anime. Like, that's not a common thing. So it felt new at the time. Of course, you know, him doing that voice and a bunch of other stuff kind of diminished that eventually, but... You know,
well, it's still something where he got to own the character. I mean, it's like, I don't know, like Steve Bloom owns Wolverine, you know, in terms of that kind of feeling. And so I don't think I don't feel it's diminished the character at all. It's just, you know, Crispin has, I've been impressed that, you know, we're 15 years down the road and he can still do the voice as well as he did it when he first started it. So. It to me, I'm just happy he can make the character's own so far down the road. And, you know, the fact is, yeah, he might be doing that same voice in other characters, but it will always be Alucard's voice.
Right. And so, you know, when you were dubbing that original TV show all those years ago, it's only like the first, you know, I think like the first third of that or the first half of it is...
The first four episodes actually follow the manga, and that point the manga wasn't that far in, so they went off the rails by episode five, I think.
Yeah, right, yeah, and then it's completely different material. So then, you know, however many years later, 6 years later, they decide to do this OVA, and it's taken almost 10 years for them to finish it. I mean, that was a tortured production, that OVA. But now that you've done the end of it, now that you've seen sort of the whole, you've dubbed the entire story, what's your personal, like, personally, what's your attitude towards that story? I mean, I would imagine maybe you're a little too close to it to give, like, a, you know, a really detached opinion, but, I mean, how did you feel about Ultimate in the end?
Well, I feel that it gives a satisfying conclusion that, you know, you sort of see where you want these characters to be. In everything, there is, you know, I mean, I could nitpick on a lot of things in the show as I watch it from start to finish, because as I did, I was nitpicking. You know, there's always like, really, do we have to like have this you know, villain monologuing forever on this particular thing? But yeah. I mean, although I will say, you know, I'm still a fan of the major speech in episode four, and even though that is quite a huge speech, but it's not monologuing, it's him sort of giving his raison d'etre for why he wants to do what he wants to do.
Right.
And, it's kind of, if you look at it as a whole, it's a great series. If you look at it, you know, individual episodes, there are some that are better than others. There are some that are much more fun than others. Some that are more like, you know, like, whoa, where did they go with that? Why did they go there with that?
Yeah.
You know, and that's one of the things about it. Helsing does have covers all the gamut. It can be comedy, it can be darkness, it can be just serious violence. It just goes into so many different areas and switches so much, even in episodes, that you just don't. You could call it black comedy, or you can just call it dark horror. You know, either way, it falls into all those categories, and that's what I like about it, and that's why I enjoy it. It never ceases to surprise me, in some ways.
Yeah, I mean the end of it, the end of Hellsing is really bizarre. I remember reading the original comics and thinking, what the hell is going on at the end of this thing? Because it just gets over the top and somehow figures out how to be even more over the top. Were the actors coming back to these roles after however many years? Did they really have to push in the booth for this? Because I can't imagine that was easy to record, like the last two, 9 and 10.
It wasn't any harder than the previous episodes, I think, because one of the good things is that we have that break between the previous episodes and the next, like the previous four that we recorded together and the last two. So we sort of had the ability to sort of watch where we were in episodes 5 through 8. And seeing where we're going in episodes 9 and 10, and see if we can sort of layer onto that, or where we need to take it bigger and where we need to pull it back. Because the idea is, you just don't want to ramp it up to, like, you know, take it to the 11.
Yeah.
So except at that one key moment where you're going to do it, and you have to bring things down, because if it's always like at an 11, you're just hearing noise basically at that
point. Right. Yeah. Yeah, that has to have been a big challenge, though, because the entire last bit of Hellsing is just at 11 the whole time.
to a certain extent, but even, like, everybody has their moments.
Right, yeah.
And they get to pull back, and then they get to go back up again. And that's why I think – if you watch episode 10, there are, like, the moments where it's like, okay, we're taking a slight break here from the intensity, and then we're going to bring it back to where it was.
Right. Yeah, well, that's that must have been tough. So now that it's over, I mean, looking back on the whole experience, are you? I mean, obviously, you're proud of the work that you did on that show. Would you consider the work you did on Hellsing to sort of be to sort of be the legacy of New Generation Pictures? I mean, would that be like your if you had to point out one achievement, would that be it?
Well, it'd probably be the easiest thing to point out.
Right.
From a company standpoint, yes, I would say it's probably one of our finest achievements. And I have to credit everybody involved with it. You know, it was a great collaborative effort from, you know, the direction of Taliesin Jaffe to all the cast, including Crispin and Katie and Victoria and Ralph. Gildert, everybody. I'm sorry if I'm not gonna, you know, this is not an Academy Award speech and I can't just name every person off the list, but there was just so much involved. And the script adapters, because we had Taliesin, you know, Taliesin was only one guy and he really, really wanted to do everything, but there were points where he said, I have limits, I can only do so much. And so he would delegate the adaptation to other great script adapters like Patrick Seitz or Mike McFarlane was involved, and we had different people involved with it, and that was one of the nice things that Taliesin was able to do, is know to say I can't do everything, and he would rely upon me and he would rely upon others to help him carry the load, and that's why it worked.
Really? Okay, interesting. And they were obviously able to, you know, not change the voice of the script, like that many hands working on a script adaptation. I would imagine maybe you might run into some stylistic choices that might, I don't know, change the way it sounds.
Oh, yeah, there were. But the thing is that once it was adapted, Taliesin could come back and look at the script and say, okay, this is good, but here's how we can make it better.
Right.
And that's what he would do and take it and adjust it and make it more the way that he felt was Hellsing.
So he would sort of come in and do a final edit.
Exactly.
Right. Huh. Wow. So, okay, so then, so when did you tape Hellsing 9 and 10?
We did it, I would say, around, I'm going to say May, June of 2014.
Okay, so pretty recently. When did you record Bayonetta?
Bayonetta was also, in June. It was interesting. Well, it's a split. Actually, it's split. I started on Bayonetta early in May because we had to. They wanted us to assemble as much of the original video game cast as possible for the dub. Now, the good news is most of the original video game cast is based in L.A. The bad news is the lead voice for Bayonetta, Helena Taylor, lives in England these days.
Right.
So, and unfortunately, it wasn't as much. Helena, I reached out to Helena. Helena and I had worked together. She lived in L.A. for a long time. She worked on ROD, the TV, for us way back when.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she was Yomiko Reedman in that.
Oh.
So that's how I knew her. And I'm sorry if you're hearing all this background noise. It seems to be some sort of construction outside my office.
It's all right.
And what happened was Helena was like, yes, I would love to reprise my role as Bayonetta, but it's really hard for me to come to the States just for, you know, a few days of recording an anime. So is there any chance that you could come out to England? And so I went to Funimation. I said, Helena's interested, but she would prefer for me to record in England. Would you be willing to have me do that? And because I consider at one point saying, well, maybe I could Skype it, director, but there's so much of a time difference between LA and the UK,
yeah,
that it just make it impossible. Plus, I really like to see the lip flaps. It's also, you get better performances when you're in the studio with the actor and you can sort of really relate to them. And they said, yeah, do it, go for it. So I actually got to fly out to England, and I went to Shepperton Studios in the UK, which is where they were. It's a famous film studio. They shot lots of Hitchcock films there. They shot 2001. They shot Alien there, not Aliens. I don't know if they shot Aliens there. And they were shooting Avengers 2 there while I was there. And the security was so tight, I was like being escorted around because they didn't want me to see anything.
Right.
But I got to record with Helena, but I didn't get to do it until after in June. So what happened was I recorded early May for Bayonetta, all the LA cast, took a hiatus. We started working on Helsing, and after Helsing was finished, I went off to England and recorded Bayonetta.
So, I mean, were you selected to dub Bayonetta chiefly due to it was sort of just like, okay, this is a good fit because tone and content wise, it's similar to what you're already doing for us, and all these actors are in LA and you're in LA, so it just kind of makes sense. I mean, what was sort of the deciding factor there?
I'm not 100% sure. That's something that Funimation knows in its,
right,
you know. But my guess, that would be a good guess. I guess also the fact that we knew a lot of the voice talent involved with it and knew how to reach them. Like, as I said, I knew how to get hold of Helena. Kind of helped, I'm sure,
right.
and as you said, there are a lot of similarities to Helsing in terms of the gunplay, the violence, the thematics, things like that.
Yeah.
So I'm sure just they might have felt, yeah, it's a good fit, but unfortunately, I couldn't speak for Funimation on that.
Right, expensive dub though. If they're sending you out to the UK just to.
Well, I mean, we timed it out well, so, you know, and of course I flew economy, so it wasn't like I was like, you know, I tried to make it work within the budget, and you know, we were able to find a good studio at Shepperton Studios. It's called the Egg Recording Studios. I should give them a plug because they really work really well for me. To work with me on this project, and you know, of course, Helena was there, and she lived very close to Shepperton, so it made things much easier. And I was just there for I was there for a week in its entirety, but we did 5 days of recording, so that's all that's how it wound up being.
So, what was the experience like working on that film. I mean, the games are sort of notorious for being, you know, extremely over the top. Not quite in the same way as Helsing, as they're more it's goofier. I would say Bayonetta's decidedly goofy. I haven't seen the film myself, but I'm wondering, like, tone-wise, you know, was it a challenge? What were the obstacles on that one?
Well, I guess the biggest challenge was they had decided to produce the anime in Japanese first, based upon the original video game, which was recorded in English first. So you took an English script and then translate into Japanese and then adapt into Japanese, and then we had to retranslate that Japanese script back into English. Weird. And then readapt it again, but then try to you lose a lot of the original game elements that were in the first game, you know, in the original game. So we had to try to bring those back into the game. And I will give credit to my script adapter, Deb Crane, for working really hard to try to bring back those game elements into the story. But of course, while it does follow the plot of the first game, they had to try to compress it, because if you play the original Bayonetta, I think the cutscenes are like add up to about 3 hours plus,
right?
In terms of stuff, so they had to sort of, you know, compress it for time, compress it for story, and at the same time try to make it interesting. So there's a lot of elements that are sort of cut out of it, but also just time compressed as well, and. That was a challenge. The second challenge for me was I never worked on on either the Bayonetta video games. That was done by Chris Zimmerman, and she directed those. I wanted to try to maintain that flavor that she had already created in the original Bayonetta games, but yet try to make it a little more anime-like and be able to be followed by somebody who had never, ever played a Bayonetta game in their life.
Right.
So I had to bring those elements in there as well, and that was my challenge as a voice director.
Right. Yeah, that's I would imagine maybe hopefully they simplified the story a little bit, because having played that first game, the story was kind of a big pile of what.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of that. There's a lot of say what's in this, but what they try to do for a lot of it is give it – they put it more – in the perspective, I would say, of it's not so much Bayonetta's story in this one as it's more like Luca's story following Bayonetta. So we're sort of being the everyman following Bayonetta and trying to understand her world.
Which is almost impossible anyway, so. Yeah, those games are bizarre. that's cool, though. So, I mean, obviously it was a high-profile project for Funimation, and they had some expectations for it.
Yeah, their biggest thing was we want all the real cast, all the original cast, and that in itself, I forgot to say, was also one of the biggest challenges, because yes, I knew Helena had done the voice of Bayonetta, and I know Yuri Lowenthal had done the voice of Luca, but if you went on IMDb back then, when the title was just announced, and if you actually looked at Bayonetta, the first video game, no credits were ever given on it. So most of the IMDb credits were wrong, because it was a bunch of fans trying to guess who they thought it sounded like.
Oh, yeah.
like two-thirds of the guesses were wrong, because I actually contacted the people that were on the list there. I mean, for example, I'll just say like Liam O'Brien was listed. And I said, hey, man, I have a great anime project we're doing. I need you to sign this non-disclosure agreement. Would you please sign it? It'll tell you all about it. And of course, we go through the whole thing. He signs the agreement, and I'm like, okay, we want you to reprise your role for Bayonetta the anime. And he goes, oh, that's great, but I never worked on it. And I'm like, oh, really? Well, do you happen to know who played the role? And it really took a lot of hunting down and trying to find the names. And in fact, there was a point where the final key component of the original cast was the character Cereza, who's the little girl in the game. And we were trying to figure out who it was, and nobody knew. Absolutely nobody knew who played that. Not even Platinum Games who, you know, produced the both Bayonetta titles. And at that point, I should say the Japanese producers of Platinum Games said no. What happened was I went to England and I was recording with Helena. And Helena was like, we had somebody else do the voice of Cereza for the game. And she was listening. She says, oh, who is that? That's not the original voice of Cereza. And I'm like, yeah, we couldn't find out who that was. I'm sorry. You know, it's like we went all over the place. And she says, oh, well, wait a second. She like makes a call to this producer. And she said, oh, it's this person. Her name is Joy Gillian. I'm like, oh, thank you so much. So after that, I sent emails to her. I sent an email to Joy Gillian's agent. And she's like, hey, are you interested in reprising the role? And she was a little girl. She was like 8 years old when she did the voice of Cereza in the first game. And now she's like 13, 14 years old. So her voice had slightly changed, but it still had the same tone, and the same warmth and innocence that it did. So we were happy to get her back and reprise the role.
Huh. Yeah, that's strange that no one had a cast list. That's bizarre.
It was really. And I guess the Japanese producer had sort of regretted the fact that he never included the credits for the original game.
Well, it was kind of a different... Weird to think about it, but it was kind of a different time, I guess.
Right.
I don't know. It wasn't that long ago, but, you know, interest in that stuff has only increased, you know, people wanting to know every single voice actor who worked on something.
Right. But now the mystery is solved and all the pieces have come together. So hopefully, you know, if they ever do it again, they'll credit people properly.
So that was, again, correct me if I'm wrong in this one, but that was your first non-legacy title for Funimation, right? I mean, you guys hadn't done anything for them other than continuing to work on projects that they had licensed after the fall of Genion. That you'd worked on the original or the first two seasons or whatever, so they were bringing you back to finish it out. But this is a new for you. It's a new IP. It's a new franchise.
Exactly. Yes, that's true.
Yeah, and so like, is that the start of a trend? Or is it just convenient timing? Do you think maybe more stuff like that's going to happen?
I can only hope so. But, right. You know, that's behind closed doors at Funimation, and I'm not sure. Right. I'm sure that the idea is that, you know, there are obviously Funimation is a very, very big company that does produce a lot of stuff in-house. And I'm sure if it's convenient for them to be able to produce it in-house, they will. When maybe the need is for them to go outside, especially when they need a full LA crew or even an overseas cast, they might seek our services. I can only hope.
Yeah, right, of course. But the question I was sort of leading into was, it's seen as rare for them to do anything outside of their own studio. They almost never hire anybody hiring somebody to actually do the recording in Los Angeles, that's rare. Usually it's just you or maybe one or two other projects on the outside, but... What would you say that is a symptom of the larger picture for the voice acting industry right now in terms of anime and how, you know, in terms of the little world that is anime voice acting, is that the new normal basically, like, you know?
Yeah, if you're not in Texas, I mean, first of all, you know, anime is not what it was 6 years ago.
No.
You know, it never will be what it was 6 years ago, where I had like 9 anime titles going simultaneously and casting, you know, as many people as were, you know, available to me in LA in these projects. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times I know Funimation really does try to diversify their cast. And while they do use a lot of their Texas actors who are great, they also try to open it up for those people who are interested and willing to fly out to Texas to work with them. And I know a lot of LA actors who have come out to Texas and work for like a few days at a time on several projects because that's what's there. They do have several projects going on there, so they'll bring them in and put them on this show and that show and the other show. Or if they're in a big show like a One Piece, they're in a huge story arc. They have them record all that story arc while they're there. So that part, I would say, it is a small. I mean, I would say the amount of players is grown in the industry, but it's become a smaller bowl that we're all in right now, and there are only a few places you can go for that stuff. You know, there are anime titles being produced here in LA, some on a regular basis, but it's a lot more people feeding, you know, trying to get, you know, so little work there is out there that compared to what it was 7-8 years ago.
Right. And so how would you characterize the Los Angeles, I guess, scene for this kind of work?
Well, since I haven't been involved with it as much as other companies, I couldn't really give you a fully expert opinion. I know there are studios out there that do produce anime on a semi-regular basis, just maybe not as many shows. They might be doing now 1, 2, or 3 shows as opposed to doing 5 to 8 shows simultaneously.
Yeah, and well, really, in Los Angeles, it's just you, Bang Zoom, and what, Studiopolis now?
Yeah, we're Studiopolis, and for the most part, yeah. And then most studios, including myself, do video games for the most part.
Yeah, which is where it's sort of how the business transitioned, right?
Yes. You had to get into video games or you would die out, basically. And there were a few studios that did die because they just couldn't make that transition over.
Right, and that's kind of a shame, but I, you know, so much work dried up. Jenny On was putting a lot of money into that.
Yeah, well, Jenny On did keep a lot of companies busy for a long time, but I mean, you had that great podcast interview where you had the guys from Jenny On explaining that they were just sort of hemorrhaging money left, you know, hand over fist.
Right.
And, you know, it didn't matter what they were doing. They were, you know, it didn't matter what titles they were releasing. They were just losing money. There were so many combination of factors, from unreasonable expectations to the loss of, you know, the bankruptcy of, you know, Sam Goody Warehouse, all those people. And they just really didn't have, when they finally thought they got things under control, Jenny On Japan said, "Oh, we're shutting down. We'll leave the dubbing and distribution to others." And that was a big hit to us. But there were some, without going into too many details, there were some elements that happened just prior to that where we sort of saw our work slow down at Jenny On a lot. And that kind of already gave us the driving force to move towards video games. So when they completely packed up and shut down, we were sort of okay at that point because we had built up our video game clientele.
So you weren't caught completely with your pants down.
No, we weren't, because we were sort of, I mean, there was, we were kind of being squeezed out at that point through some circumstances that I can't really discuss right now, but
right.
There were other companies that were basically trying to dominate and control the anime dubbing industry at that point.
At least in Los Angeles, yeah.
Right, for sure. Right.
Yeah, no, those stories go around, isn't it? It's not...
So we rather than just sort of saying, oh, gee, we can't really, you know, we should just, you know, put our heads in the sand and just cry and hope that things... We said, no, look, we just have to focus on other things. We have these skill sets. Let's apply them elsewhere. And we started applying them towards video games. And we sort of came in and just... We came at the right time. We got, you know, we got... to meet with Capcom, and got to work on Street Fighter, and we got to work with Square Enix on several of their titles, and then we started working with other companies as well. So it just worked out better for us. So in the long run, it was probably a good thing, because if we had put all our eggs into one basket into anime, we probably would have died at that point.
Yeah, that's it's interesting. So you basically saw the writing on the wall and started making the move to save yourselves ahead of time. Which is good, and also, you know, if I'm not mistaken, the common wisdom indicates that video games pay better than...
They do, for the most part. You know, there are always low-budget titles and things like that, but it definitely does pay better for all sides, both on the production end and on the acting end. So, you know, a lot of people prefer to work in video games. the thing you miss about when you work in anime is having this sort of linear storyline that's you can build and develop characters and work with actors to develop their character. In video games, it's not like that because you're usually doing, okay, here are your storylines. We as directors have to fill in the gaps and say, okay, this is what's going on here. This is what's going on here. And it's hard to really create as much characterization as you can with anime where you're like, okay, you start episode 1 and you get to episode 26 and there's a whole story arc and a characterization arc for all these different characters that you're directing.
Yeah, and plus you're stuck sitting there, the player wants to go west, you have to record that line, and if they want to go south, you have to record that line, and you're recording, it's a lot of repetition.
Exactly. There's always a lot of that, and there's always just a lot of, okay, now we've done all the storylines, now let's do all the battle lines. You know, so it's like, ha, how many ha's and how many ya's and how many I'll get you or, oh, you know, all those different lines that you have to do, basically.
Yeah. So, I mean, do you see those sort of salad days or the glory days compared to now? Or, I mean, you sound pretty comfortable with the way things are now.
I'm happy where I am now. I always tell this whenever I run into like people I work with in anime. It's like, man, I miss anime. It was a lot of fun. I don't miss, it was a bit hard in terms of, our budgets weren't that great. We had to try to make do with what we had. But everybody sort of pulled together and did a great job. And that was what was great, was we always got to pull rabbits out of hats all the time. And the results, were like Helsing. So that was a lot of fun.
Right. Yeah. And, during the years where the bubble, you're sort of at the peak of the bubble, when there's a lot of money going around, everybody's happy, when you get to the end of that, when the bubble was bursting and everybody's, racing to the bottom, driving your prices into the ground, that kind of thing, that can't have been a fun time to go
through. No, it wasn't. I just remember, it was like, how are we going to do this? And we tried different elements. We tried different ways to make it work. And, it could have worked in some ways, but there was this thing about what I always felt was we had a certain quality standard for New Generation Pictures dubs, and we didn't want to go below that level. And there was a point where they were asking us to cut our budget so low that we knew we would have to compromise our quality, and we just had to say no. And that was what happened eventually.
Right. And you're still in business, so.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Yes. Knock on wood, right?
Right. But, I mean, speaking of the video game work, so you mentioned doing stuff for, like, mobile or, like, tablet games, things like that. Obviously, there's just, like, that sort of a boom industry right now. Are you getting a lot of work like that for mobile games?
A decent amount of work. I work with different companies, like Zen Studios is one of my bigger clients. They produce all the, I don't know if you ever heard of it, the Zen Pinball series. They do these virtual pinball tables. You can get them for both your smartphone, your iPhone, consoles, portable consoles. They're really great. And because they're virtual, they can create a lot of story in the 3D animated characters and story involved with these pinball tables. So you think, well, pinball, what's that? But it becomes more interactive as a result. And they also have the license on the Marvel Comics line. So they produce a lot of Marvel Comics themed pinball tables, which do have a lot of huge interactive stories to them. And I do a lot of the voice casting for that and direction for those as well. And they're a lot of fun to work on.
Right. So if you're doing those Marvel tables, are you bringing back people that worked on Marvel vs. Capcom?
We have on some of those. And sometimes the budget's not big enough to do it. But we have done it. Like, we recently did it for we did a Deadpool table, and we had Nolan North do the voice of Deadpool for that.
Right.
Well, that's cool. And it's always fun to work with Nolan in the booth. He's just the hoot.
All right. So it sounds like things are going pretty good.
I can't complain. There's always the saying, it could be better, it could be worse. I'm just happy where I am right now.
Right. Before we get to the Twitter questions, though, I wanted to ask about this because I was looking through your Wikipedia page, and I noticed that it seems like the earliest credit you have is the 3DO Jurassic Park game. Is that accurate?
Yes, it was. It was something we worked on many, many, many years ago.
Yeah.
It was more like we localized that into Japanese, I believe, not into English. So that was it was a reverse localization.
So you worked on the Japanese dub of the Jurassic Park game. That is a weird credit.
It is, but it was kind of funny. And of course, we were like, "Wow, 3DO, this is going to be great." It was like, "Oh, next week, what's 3DO?"
Yeah, well, it's kind of a special game. So you had to like voice match. You know, you had to find a Japanese guy to do Jeff Goldblum and all that stuff.
Yeah, we sort of worked in an advisory capacity for that element. They did the voice recordings in Japan, I believe, for all that. We just sort of helped out. They sent us samples and we did little localizations here and there.
That's fun.
It was a weird time. It was definitely a different time. We were also just starting to get into localization. It was, you know, it was years before we actually started doing more video, you know, like the whole slew of, I think it was even before we started doing anime, as far as I remember. We had done a lot of localization for corporate clients from Japanese into English and from English to Japanese. And we had, I believe, somehow we had worked with Universal Interactive on this. And they were like, "Oh yeah, we want you to do this Jurassic Park game." So they asked us to help them out with that. But I think that was at the time, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it was still at the time when Matsushita Panasonic owned Universal. So that's why I think we were sort of doing with that.
Oh, yeah, interesting. Well, so that the credit on that is 94 for the actual release of it.
Yeah.
Which would make this your 20th year, I guess.
Yeah, we started technically we started New Generation Pictures in my garage in 1993. Actually opened our office in Beverly Hills in 95. Okay. So there's our office anniversary, and then there's our founding anniversary. So yeah, we passed our 20th. We sort of passed our 20th anniversary last year, but our 20th office anniversary, where we actually had a company where people could walk in and sort of see an office, and it has been since 95.
Right. Huh. Okay. All right. Let's go ahead and get some of these Twitter questions here. Jose CNN asks, how difficult was it to make a dub like Helsing with so many big gaps in between episodes thanks to licensing issues?
It's kind of like what I describe is like the beginning of the Blues Brothers, where they're trying to bring the band back together again. You know, it's you're gone for so many years and you got to find and hunt down each individual voice actor and find out where they are. Now, granted, a lot of them were still in L.A., but there was a time, I mean, after the stuff we had done with Jenny on, several of the voice actors sort of went off in their own direction. For example, Katie Gray, who has a wonderful music career, moved to Seattle, and she had moved to Denver, and she'd gone all over these places. I remember on different volumes having to find her in different places. Ralph Lister lives in Michigan now, where he does books on tape there and also has a very healthy on-camera acting career. And so we had to sort of find and track all these people and then bring them back to the studio all within a certain limited time frame. And it got complicated. It got more and more complicated after Volume 4 to do that.
Yeah.
So I mean, it's always a challenge, but, you know, thank God Crispin Freeman has lived in L.A. since we started Helsing. That's all I have to say.
There's a similar question about Iggy Tosin, specifically related to the fact that you taped it both in L.A. and New York.
Yes. Seasons 3 and 4 we did. It was more of an interesting challenge. You know, we worked on season 1. We didn't get to work on season 2. Season 2 was produced in New York, which... again, long story. Don't know how to get into it right now, but yeah. It was done by Joe DiGiorgi at Headline Studios, and then season 1 was acquired by Funimation, And then they acquired seasons 3 and 4, and they came to us and said, hey, would you like to pick up when you left off on seasons 3 and 4? And we said, yes. And then the big question became, well, after season 1, a bunch of new characters were introduced in season 2 that now appear in seasons 3 and 4. How do you want us to handle it? Do you want us to try to get the original cast that appeared in season 2, or do you want us to just cast with the LA talent? And Funimation said, you're welcome to do whatever you want. If you can get the original cast back where they come out to L.A., great, as long as you stay within the budget. And what happened was I realized, well, I grew up in New York. I have family in New York. Maybe I could just go out there for a few weeks and record the New York talent, at least as many of them as I can get a hold of, and have them fill in the holes for all the season 2 characters that were cast. And so I reached out to people, some of the people I already knew and some of the people I had to be introduced to. And everybody was like, yeah, if you're coming out to New York, I'll do it. And so that's how we did it. And it worked out really well. And I'm very happy that we were sort of create this amalgam of first season and second season cast together in seasons 3 and 4.
Yeah, do you find that kind of dub continuity, like, from season to season, where do you see the most, like, feedback from that? Is just, like, fans of the show really get upset when it's not the same cast?
I remember reading, like, after season one, after we had done season one and we thought we were going to do season two, after it was sort of, you know, there was this point where Ikitosin season two was sort of in limbo for several years, and finally they sort of kept the there was this point where people were bothering me saying, are you working on the dub? Are you working on the dub? Are you working on the dub? And I just finally had to, like, post online and said, no, we're not working on the dub. I'm sorry. And I believe none of the original voice actors involved with it at all. And there was, like, this sort of, oh man, that sucks. You know, I'm not going to buy this. You know, screw Media Blasters for not using you. And I'm like, and I know there was that initial reaction. Now, whether those people actually didn't buy the dub, I don't know. So, yes, there's always a bit of backlash, but I do see it online. But I think the fans were pretty happy that I sort of reached out to the season 2 cast and said, hey, why don't we all do this together? You know, bring back both. Let's have the best of both worlds. All the new characters that were introduced in season 2, try to get their original voice actors. All the original actors from season 1, bring them back as much as possible, and make all the fans happy from both seasons. And I think in the end, those people who are fans of the show were happy with the end result.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I'm pretty sure that they still bought the second season because,
right, you know, exactly. I'm sure people were just sort of like, oh man, sorry you got screwed over, and you know, like, oh, they probably put in their pre-order for season 2 anyway. But.
And you know, no offense intended, I am not certain that Ikitosin is a show that is purchased chiefly for the voice performances.
No, I don't, but it's Ikitosin has a little place in my heart, or in my chest,
right.
Whatever. It was our first – it wasn't our first fan service title, but it was like the first fan service title that actually sort of struck a chord everywhere. It was like suddenly people were actually – you know, it was not expected to do well for Genion when they released it. They had no high sales expectations, and when it went – and when the sales were through the roof, they were like, oh, wow, this is great. Who knew? Yeah, big boobs and fan service sell.
Yeah, they were surprised by that. Okay,
they were, and then, you know, so we were like, oh, and we got accolade. I mean, we were even in contact with Media Factory, the producers for season 2, because I had met them at Comic K when they announced season 2, and they were like, oh, we really love what you did on season 1. We're looking forward to working with you on season 2, and I'm like, yeah, great. Thanks. And we were like looking forward to getting season 2. And then Jenny came to us and said, that was when they were, or, you know, they were at that point where they were losing money hand over fist. And they were like, we didn't buy season 2. And I was like, okay, who got it? And they said, we don't know. And I thought it was ADV, because at that point ADV was in a bidding war with them. And they had, and Media Factory actually tipped our told us that those two companies are having a bidding war. So I suggest you actually talk to ADV and see if they'd be interested in using you for the show. And we did talk to John Ledford, and he said, "Yeah, if we get it, we'd certainly want to talk to you about doing the show." So I thought our bases were covered, but it turned out ADV had not gotten the show too. And then we went through the whole list. You know, is it Funimation? Nope. Is it Right Stuff? Nope. Is it Viz? Nope. And then is it Bandai? Nope. And then we realized, oh no, it went to Media Blasters. And we knew at that point we probably weren't going to get it. Yeah. So
greeted by the friendly face of John Cerebella.
Yeah, so it was kind of a little bit of a disappointment, but in the end, you know, it worked out. We got to do seasons 3 and 4, and the special that came after it. So I can't complain, and we put together something I think the fans will be happy with. And you know, I mean, Iggy Tosin is not everybody's cup of tea. There's always going to be a lot of condemnation for, oh, it's a fan service title. Oh, it's so awful. It's just, you know, it's just objectifying women. And I wholeheartedly agree. Yes, it is. That's exactly what it's about. But we had fun doing it, and everybody involved with it had a lot of fun doing it. And so nobody came on the show saying, oh, you know, I hate doing these types of shows. We all had a lot of fun. And I think that comes out in the performances you see with the cast. So that's why I think shows in the dub.
All right. Yeah, I don't. I think condemning things just for being fan service shows, those days are kind of over, I think.
At this point, I think every show has a certain amount of fan service,
yeah,
no matter what.
Yeah, it's everywhere. So, you know, you get two shows like Iggy Tosin every season at this point.
Right. So. Well, that was the whole thing. It sort of created the trend. I would say it was the first fan service show ever, but no. It sort of set the mark for others to follow.
It was a huge hit, and so they did more. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then we get, and every time they announce a new one, it's like, I can't believe they're making another one of those. But in Japan, those figures sell like hotcakes. So, you know, they want to move those products. So the best way to move the product is to create more shows that display those characters in different costumes and different outfits and introduce new girls to have, uniforms of tissue.
Yeah. You probably can't answer this, but I'll ask it anyway. Boy of Revolution wants to know if you've been approached by Aniplex to do a dub for them.
At this point, no. I can't answer it because the answer is no. I have not been employed. And it's kind of sad because I do know all the people at Aniplex a lot. Most of them used to be the people I worked with at Genion and Pioneer. But for whatever reasons they may have, they have never approached our company to do a dub for them. But if they ever do, our door is always open to them.
Okay. Madman 400 wants to know how you're able to hire certain union-only voice actors for certain Funimation dubs.
Well, if the answer is like for Bayonetta and Helsing, the answer is we made it union.
Right.
They're both SAG projects.
Shocker! That almost never happens.
Yes, I know. Well, I think that was also one of the reasons why the Funimation came to us, because they knew they wouldn't be able to produce these projects as non-union projects, so they needed a SAG signatory on there.
Yep. He also asked, which was answered by Greg Weisman. He said, how did you get Greg Weisman for Iggy Tosin, even in the Funimation licensed sequels? Greg responded to this tweet saying that you asked, and he said yes. So is that it?
Well, that is true. But in greater detail, Greg and I are old friends. He was actually – I knew him when I went to USC in college as a film school. He was actually my English composition teacher.
Really?
And yes, and you know, he was like a grad student at that time, and they, you know, a lot of grad students did teach the courses like English comp, and he was actually writing for DC Comics at that time, Captain Atom, and I recognized him, and we built up a friendship, And he, I have to credit him because he's the one who got me to go to Japan the first time, or helped in part for me to go to Japan, because there was this student exchange conference called the Japan-American Student Conference that I was involved with that got me to Japan. And one of the things was to write an essay about why you wanted to go to Japan. And, of course, I wrote my essay, but then I went and visited Greg. I said, could you review this and tell me if this sounds right? And he reviewed and gave me some tips about where I should, you know, clean it up and shorten it and things like that. And I submitted it, and I got accepted to the conference program and was able to go to Japan. And that's how my sort of my career path led to where I am today.
Okay. Chimichunga asks, what was it like recording with Liam O'Brien and Karen Thompson and some of the old Jenny On shows? He says, I always loved their performances.
Well, I love working with both Liam and Karen. You know, they worked together with me on Ergo Proxy, mm-hmm. which was, I think the last show I did for Jenny On officially. It was just one of those things that they're both a lot of fun in the booth. And Liam has always been great to have in the booth. He's just the amount of voices that come out of that man is incredible. He's just a super talent. And Karen Thompson, she is just a sweetheart. And I wish I could work with her again. She's moved to Northern California, so it's been a bit hard to be in contact with her, but she's great. And I hope that someday, may that day come soon, I'll be able to work with her again.
All right, excellent. Okay, that actually that wraps us up. Can't thank you enough for stopping by and giving us the update.
Well, thank you for having me. I hope I didn't bore everybody to death. That's the one thing. I know I'm not like the greatest storyteller there is. I'm sure that you've had on your podcast, but maybe someday, maybe in a few more years, I'll have some more interesting stories to tell.
You got to get real grizzled and old and bitter.
Yes.
And then you can.
Damn that anime! It ruined my life.
I want to hear the whiskey bottle smash against the wall.
Right. We'll share. Well, I'm sure, you know, the next time we get together at the AX industry party, we'll have some interesting stories to tell. I don't know if they'll be suitable for podcasts, but we'll at least be able to share amongst ourselves.
Excellent. All right.
All right. Well, thanks, Zach. And thanks, everybody, for supporting our work, whether it's our video games or the anime, especially Hellsing Ultimate and Bayonetta Bloody Fate. Or if you're a fan of our past work, which will, fortunately, Funimation has picked up and rescued a lot of those titles. So they're still out there. You know, drop us a line. Let us know what you think. And thanks again for being a fan.
Okay, that's our show. Big thanks to Jonathan for stopping by. The theme song is Bucharest. It's by the band The New Division. You can check them out at newdivisionmusic.com. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes. Leave us a rating or review. We would really appreciate it. And we'll see you all next week.